abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, December 16th, 2013, and we are joined today by Robert Higgs. And if you don't know who Bob Higgs is, well, this is your lucky day because you're going to get exposed to one of the great libertarian scholars out there who's just an outstanding economist and historian, and indeed economic historian by any standard, but who's made such important contributions in so many areas. I am just thrilled to have a chance to sit down and talk to him. Before we get to him, very, very quick announcements. Just a reminder, we're going to be taking a quick break around Christmas time on this program. December 23rd, a week from today, will be the last program until 2014. We will resume on January 2nd. I'm going to take a little breather, be with the family, and, of course, I'm also doing all this work for RonPaulHomeschool.com, which is driving me totally insane, even though I know in theory it's important work. So this will also help me to catch up a little bit on that. So we'll see you again after the 23rd on January 2nd. Remember the secret deal that's available to you guys who listen to this program, 35% off at my LibertyClassroom.com, which is the ideal gift for the liberty lover in your family. But that is available only to people who listen to this program. It's on a secret page. What would that page be? LibertyClassroom.com/secret. Only you guys know about this. I haven't tweeted it. It's not on Facebook. I haven't blogged it. Nothing. So that's just for you guys for your gift-giving pleasure. And then finally, don't forget, you are helping us pay our bills in our little Tom Woods Show office slash studio here by entering Amazon at TomWoodsRadio.com when you're about to make your purchases. And at no cost to you, you can help us pay the bills. All right, let's turn now to the great Bob Higgs. Dr. Higgs is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's also a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute, where he served as editor of the Independent Review from 1995 to 2013, and he is now editor-at-large. He's taught at several universities, been a visiting scholar at Oxford and Stanford, and earned his own PhD at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of many books, perhaps best known of which is Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government. This is the book, I think, that introduced the world to Bob Higgs, but he's got many other important books as well. Against Leviathan, Government Power and a Free Society, Resurgence of the Warfare State, The Crisis Since 9/11, and Depression, War, and Cold War, Studies in Political Economy. His most recent book is Delusions of Power, New Explorations of the State, War, and Economy. Bob Higgs, thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Well, there's so much to talk about with somebody like you who's been writing so much and speaking so much over the course of his life, but I want to start off with a little bit regarding the connection between war and government growth. And I want to actually start off by playing sort of devil's advocate, because let's suppose I look around the world, I look at Canada, I look at Mexico, I look at the South American countries, most European countries, almost none of them really have substantial military establishments that would compare. I mean, basically none of them have anything like the U.S., which pretty much dwarfs the rest of the world. And yet they all have very, very substantial public sectors. They have very, very big governments. So if everybody basically winds up with a big government after going through the 20th century, everybody wound up this way, couldn't you make the argument that, well, I guess after all, war couldn't have been that big of a played that big of a role because everybody winds up as a big government?
You could make that argument, Tom, but you'd have to ignore the history of how those various governments came to be as big as they are today. One of the things that happens in modern war, wars like those in the past century or so, is that, of course, the government mobilizes a large part of the economy for war making, often adopting more or less centralized control of, if not all resources, at least a large part of them, and controls prices and, in many cases in the World Wars, for example, conscripted workers on a very large scale and so forth. Now, that looks like the sort of thing that, all right, it creates big government during the time that the war is going on, but the war ends and then those things go away. And in any event, even if they don't go away completely, it's still just military-related aspects of government controls. But what has actually happened in the war emergencies, especially during the two world wars, is that during the war, government doesn't simply expand along strictly military lines. In fact, the tendency is to expand almost across the board so that opportunists of various kinds take advantage of the wartime situation, which reduces the normal obstructions and resistance that government faces when it seeks to expand, reduces them in a way that allows non-war-related interests to obtain what they were probably seeking for a long time beforehand. So when you come out of the war, you've got a lot of things that have grown in government, many of which are not going to simply go away because they can't be justified anymore. The war is over now. They will look as if, in fact, having got underway during the war or greatly strengthened or enlarged during the war, then the end of the war provides all the greater reason for keeping them and making them even bigger than they were. So I think when people look at what actually has happened historically, they see that warfare and welfare as state activities in some general sense have tended to go together. And you see that, for example, in the greatest welfare states, people have often pointed out to me that Sweden has a very large government, as these things are usually measured, and yet Sweden was not even a belligerent in the World Wars. And that is true. However, what did happen during the World Wars in Sweden was that the Swedish government prepared to be a belligerent. And so even though it didn't fight, it did the very same things that were being done by the governments that were belligerents in those wars, and with the same results. And so Sweden ended up with a huge welfare state. But, of course, so did France and Germany and practically all the other Western European countries. And with a little bit of a lag, so did the United States, Canada, and Australia, New Zealand, and other places where the European civilization had been expanded abroad.
You know, I started off wanting to talk more about war specifically, but talking about the welfare state, this prompts just a series of questions in my mind. There are a couple of different ways we can look at the welfare state and the state in general. We can look at the welfare state as a benign thing that's introduced by well-meaning people, and it just happens to go wrong, that people happen to become dependent on it, and this was no part of the intention, but that's what happens. Or it could be the welfare state was intended with there were sinister intentions behind it. We do want like Bismarck, we want the people to become dependent on the regime. That's why we're introducing it. And this whole thing is a subset of a more general disagreement that we might identify with Murray Rothbard and David Friedman. Because if you read Rothbard's Anatomy of the State, he takes a very much the sinister view that the state, look, it's this entity that just wants to advance its interests. The individuals who are part of it want to expand their power, and they do so by monopolizing certain power centers in society. Whereas David Friedman's view is that he doesn't find it persuasive that the state officials are all sinister and they're all just entirely self-interested. His view is that probably most state officials believe that without the state, things would be much, much worse for everyone. So is it possible to reconcile these two views, or do you come down more on one side or the other?
Well, I think there's obviously an element of both going on historically in the West, at least, and there's no gainsaying that many of the friends of the welfare state over the past century or century and a half were sincere believers in it. At the same time, it's pretty easy to see that, as I mentioned earlier, the war provides a golden opportunity for opportunists of all kinds, including those who have been trying to create or expand the welfare state. And in a lot of cases, especially in the European countries, many of the welfare state type government actions or programs that came into being during wartime were put there as a way to placate people for their suffering, for the costs they were bearing while government transferred so many resources from butter to guns. And along with that attempt to placate people to say, all right, you know, I know we've used all the lumber to build shipyards, so there's no lumber to build apartments for the shipyard workers to live in. They've created things like, say, daycare centers for the workers' kids. They've created government housing for the workers to live in. And of course, once you do something like that, you create a precedent, you give people new ideas, and you soften up people who wouldn't have liked those kinds of government programs before, because you can always go to them and say, look, we did this during the war, and it worked pretty well. We can do it even better in peacetime. And all those things have happened historically. So I think one needs to view this process not as an either-or matter, but as a process of reciprocation of these two kinds of people and these two kinds of motives interacting constantly with one another.
Well, it's easy to imagine how these types of people can persuade the public that the welfare state is a benign thing, because, of course, we're just trying to provide for your material needs. But they've even tried to persuade them that for all the sacrifices that people have to make during wartime, on the home front, it sure gets the factories churning out goods, and it gets people employed. It's got people persuaded that war is actually a net benefit for them. Now, do you think in your corpus of work there is any subject where you've had a bigger influence? Because I think now people who still say that World War II was a boon for the economy are either just, I mean, they can be ignorant not through any fault of their own. They could just be innocent people just trying to work day to day and they don't have time to read the scholarly literature. But, I mean, you'd either have to be ignorant or dishonest, I think, at this point, without any caveats whatsoever, to try to claim that World War II was a time of great prosperity. Do you think that's your most lasting contribution in terms of not just influencing libertarian minds, but also the mainstream?
I really don't know, Tom. I've had some effect there, I think, in arguing against the kind of vulgar Keynesian idea that war got the U.S. economy out of the Great Depression. But even there, it's pretty obvious to me that my influence has been very spotty. I think I have had some influence among the academic economic historians, but if you look at the macroeconomists in the mainstream who write about the Great Depression, my work is almost unknown to them, either because they ran across it and thought it was not worth taking into account, or because they just never ran across it. And I think some people don't really understand the extent to which, say, a macroeconomist in a top university lives in a very tightly enclosed universe of scholarship and research. It's a relatively small handful of people who are writing papers aimed at one another, basically, and they're trying to do things like to use new techniques, and they're trying to show off that they've been able to solve some technical problem that has arisen in econometrics or something of that sort. They're not reading the historical literature on the Depression or World War II. Most of the time, they know almost nothing about it other than the statistical series they can pull off of a standard database, like the one that the St. Louis Fed maintains. And that won't really tell you anything outside of that, again, very narrow framework of thinking about what was going on. And this is, I know it's probably hard for people outside the profession of economics to believe that people can be so blinkered, but they really are. And so I think to this day, if you took a random sample of people who teach and do research in macroeconomics and just ask them, have you ever heard of Robert Higgs? I think probably not more than 5%, if that, would say yes. And if you ask them, what do you think of his ideas about World War II in relation to getting the economy out of the Depression, I think you just draw almost a universal blank. I don't think they know this kind of argument at all, and if it were put in front of them, I think they would dismiss it because it doesn't just hew the typical line that macroeconomists hew about what kinds of data they look at and what they think they mean or don't mean. And that's a big part of my argument, is basically quarreling with the national income and product accounts and saying, this is baloney. Of course, when the government comes to suddenly spend for almost 50% of the GDP, yeah, GDP is going to balloon up. So what? What does it mean? What are you getting for that? But those aren't the kinds of questions that economists in general and macroeconomists in particular are interested in asking or answering.
What is it exactly, I don't know, philosophically or economically that you need to break down in their heads in order to get them to understand your point, which seems so clear to the rest of us?
Well, I think in a way it's impossible, Tom, because as long as they view the national income and product account as the data, they're never going to understand the heart of my argument. Now, one of the main reasons why they haven't bothered to even look at it, I'm sure, is that when a macroeconomist looks at a piece of work, he's expecting to see a formal mathematical model and a bunch of econometric exercises. And that's not the kind of work I did on this issue. I did it in other parts of my career on other issues, but I didn't do it on the question of the effects of World War II on the economy. So they look at it and they say, no model, no econometrics, nothing. That is the way they evaluate research. You got no model, you got no econometrics, you got nothing.
On the other hand, people can read what you write. You know, like there is still an old-fashioned benefit to that, if you ask me. Well, at the once you and I finish chatting, I will leave people with the URL for a special page where I've put up links to your work on this so they can follow exactly what your argument is. But I want to shift gears a little bit because I'm very interested in the evolution of Robert Higgs as a thinker over the years. I mean, I first read Crisis and Leviathan in the early 1990s, and I was very, very interested in it, so I've been following your work ever since, and I read your initial article on the World War II question, and I just kept on following it. But then, if I read your blog post today, or if I read your Facebook updates, it's like, if not a different person, a much more in-your-face anti-state person. So what has changed in your thinking? Maybe you look at the world differently, or is it the world has just become so grotesque that it made you go back and say, you know what, I used to be willing to give the state, you know, a little bit of quarter, I was willing to allow the state this and that, but now, given the experiences I've had observing the world, I just can't give them even that anymore? Like, what happened in your mind?
Well, I think your latter option there is pretty close to what happened in my thinking, Tom. The part of what colored my original work in political economy, which really started in the broad sense in the early 1980s was a participation in the academic debates that were involved in this issue. My colleague at University of Washington, Douglas North, was regarded as the expert, or at least one of the leading experts among economic historians, in the interplay of government and the economy. And so Doug and I, back in the 70s, used to talk about some aspect of this almost every day. And finally, I developed my views to the point where I thought, well, now I'll try actually writing something that will make a professional contribution in this area. And when one does that, of course, one has to situate his own articles and books relative to the existing scholarly work. But by doing that, one confines himself. And one allows, as it were, the previous researchers to set the limits and define the terms of the debate. And at that time, I was much more inclined, therefore, to take seriously a lot of the orthodox explanations for the growth of government, things related to governments dealing with externalities and provision of public goods and blah, 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 all the ways in which government is alleged to have responded to so-called market failures. With the passage of time, with more and more research into how various government activities and programs actually got started, how they were perpetuated and enlarged, it became obvious to me that these standard ways that the economics profession was approaching the issues was just irrelevant. They had almost nothing to do with the actual history of the growth of government. And at the same time, the more I learned about government, the more difficult it became for me to take seriously all of the public interest claims that political actors, both the politicians themselves and people who are seeking various policies and laws, were making. Claims about how the public interest would be promoted. It became more and more obvious that almost everything the state does is an attempt to aggrandize its own leading actors and to transfer wealth from a looted class to a looting class. And, of course, this is all bound up with ideology, because you can't just go out in public and tell people, I want this program because it's going to enrich and empower me and allow me to enrich my cronies who support me for political office. So that doesn't feed the baby politically. So you have to go out and cover everything in a fog of ideological obfuscation. And so that's the kind of fog in which political discourse is constantly submerged. And it makes it more difficult to cut through who's doing what, why. But if one is serious about his scholarship, you can eventually, I think, get a much firmer understanding of who was doing what and why. And when I did that, it led me to almost totally abandon any ideas I'd started out with about government as a solution to any kind of real problem. To be Reagan-esque about it, government is the problem, regardless of what part of the social landscape, economic landscape you look at. Almost everything that's wrong there would be better if government hadn't been involved. And so I think if one is serious about history and serious about learning enough economics to interpret history, then it becomes almost impossible to put a smiley face on the state and its growth. And that's what happened to me. And of course, the state does so many, many things that are simply outrageous and cruel and barbaric and savage that, you know, what kind of person wants to support that sort of organization? It's just a bunch of criminals at the top and on the supporting areas. And, of course, many decent people get dragged into this. They're lost in the ideological fog. But the movers and shakers are not lost in the fog. Most of them know what they're doing. They're aggrandizing themselves. They're accumulating power, and they're enriching themselves and their cronies.
All right, I think I'm understating the case then if I say that your view on politics is one in which politics is unlikely to solve our problems, that running for office and getting elected and voting for people is unlikely to solve our problems. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I'm on solid ground there. So let me ask you then, if politics is more of a waste of time or a distraction, then what kind of theory of social change do we entertain to imagine the transition away from a system like this toward a more humane system that doesn't involve politics? Or is it indeed possible to imagine a transition away from the current system?
It's possible. The fact that the development of all this statism and the apparatus of the state has become so gargantuan, it doesn't guarantee in any way that it'll last forever. If the state leaders are so obtuse, and I think they can be so obtuse, that they push beyond the limits of what can be borne, that is, they push the economy and the society into a situation where the government's domination results in a mass impoverishment of people, then I think we can fairly easily imagine rebellion, so that if not overthrow the whole system, a very substantial recasting of it. Perhaps that's what happened in the Soviet Union. But in any event, one can certainly imagine that the current system will not simply get worse and worse forever. I do think it's going to, in the United States, get worse for quite a long time before there's some kind of a reaction against it that will be substantial. Along the way, I expect to see a lot of ebb and flow around the edges, but ultimately it's going to threaten the goose that lays the golden eggs, propping all of these politicos and their cronies up. And at that point, something more serious will have to happen. But meanwhile, for those of us who must live in the midst of this mess, I think it's a much better bet for people to look at this situation not from a societal perspective, not from a how can we change the system perspective, but from the perspective of what can I, as an individual, with my family, do to wriggle out from under, avoid, evade, escape, beat the system? How can I actually do something that's open to me right now or can be made open to me in some way? What can I do? I just think this politicking is a lost cause in the current context. The American people and the people of Western Europe are sunk in statist thinking, and it's just such a long odds project to suppose that we can somehow educate them or open their eyes in a way that will be politically productive, that I think people really owe it to themselves and their families to start looking around at how they can walk away from this system, to do whatever is necessary to avoid its harmful effects on them and their families.
Well, after an answer like that, I'm afraid this final question is so anticlimactic. But before letting you go, I did want to know, from your point of view as a scholar, are there any areas in economic history, or indeed economics or history separately, that you'd like to see young scholars focus on, where there's good work to be done that may have indeed some libertarian implications to it?
Oh, I think there are many, many areas of research that young people can launch into. I still believe that World War II, where I did a good deal of work myself, has a tremendous number of possibilities connected with some aspect of it for research, because the government was so big during the war, did so many things, and also World War II was, as you know, extensively documented. There were millions of clerks in the government during the war, keeping records, eight at a time, and so there's a lot of evidence and information available, along with standard things such as memoirs and newspapers and what have you, but there's a lot of agency relics in the archives now that researchers could use. And so I think World War II is a very important area where good research can be done and should be done. But there are also many areas connected with the post-war economy that also cry out for more work, because for a long time the work was just what economists did on current events. But that work, as I've suggested already, was colored and confined by what was the orthodox approach of economists. And one can certainly go back and redo that from a more intelligent perspective. Go back, for example, and look at the development of the welfare state in the 1960s and early 70s from a more Austrian economics perspective, from a more realistic political economy perspective, rather than this old standard mainstream macro / market failure perspective that has been the main way in which economists and, following them, the mainstream economic historians have dealt with that material. And, of course, there are many, many others. I know your listeners don't want to hear me go on about all the opportunities for good research, but those two certainly are candidates.
Well, Bob Higgs, I'm so grateful for your time and for all your work. Thanks so much for being here. I can't wait for people to hear this. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we will be joined by Michael Matheson Miller of PovertyCure.org about poverty in the developing world and what's the best way to approach it. It's not the same old ways they've tried over and over and over and over again. It's time to think a new way. We'll talk to Michael Matheson Miller about that tomorrow. So make sure and tune in and subscribe to the program on iTunes, everybody. Oh, wait a minute. I almost forgot. I have a page where I've put up Bob Higgs's argument in his own words about World War II. If you're interested in this issue that we've been kind of dancing around here in the conversation, if you want the full explanation from Dr. Higgs about why World War II was not a time of prosperity, then head over to this page that's open to the public. It's libertyclassroom.com/war. At libertyclassroom.com/war, you'll get the full explanation of what Dr. Higgs is arguing, and I think you'll find it totally compelling. It really demolishes the conventional wisdom on World War II as a time of prosperity. That does not survive the Higgs analysis. Okay, that really is the end of the program for today. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.